I'm so honored to have and privileged to have gotten this guy on the telephone, Dr. Peter J. Hotez. You've seen him on CNN, MSNBC, NBC, on and on and on. Director for the Center of Vaccine Development at Texas Children's Hospital, the endowed chair in tropical pediatrics at Texas Children's Hospital, dean for the National School of Tropical Medicine, Baylor College of Medicine, professor of departments of pediatrics and molecular virology and microbiology at Baylor College of Medicine, faculty fellow, Hagler Institute for Advanced Study at Texas A&M University, College Station, Texas, and university professor, Department of Biology at Baylor, and works on neglected tropical diseases and vaccination for developing nations. And you know what? I could go on, but we would be out of time. Dr. Hotez, thank you very, very much for joining us today, and welcome to WGN Radio.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's an honor to have you here, and this is where I think I will start. Did you ever think that the United States would be a world leader when it comes to the coronavirus? It's not a place where we want to be a world leader, but in incidence of the virus and in deaths from the virus, we sadly are.
No, it's just so tragic. I'm remembering that I first heard about this virus on New Year's Day. That's when the Chinese publicly released information, and never dreamed that we would let it get to 330,000 American lives lost by the end of the year. I'm still in shock how we let things get so out of hand here.
Interesting the way you put it. Let it get out of hand. Now, you're not a political person, I'm sure, but what do you say to people? Because I hear this, that say it's a hoax, that doctors are including flu numbers, and that is why, the only reason why numbers are so high, that doctors are actually being paid to report someone died of COVID, that it's all been exaggerated, it's the fault of the media. I mean, how do you answer people who truly, in their bones, feel what I just said?
Well, you know, I have some sympathy because they're the victims of what's been a very aggressive disinformation campaign, which includes all of those false statements that you just made. And it was launched by the White House. It was launched by the White House Coronavirus Task Force. And then later in the summer, the president put this guy, Scott Atlas, in charge of it. And his order apparently was to provide that disinformation, to say that COVID-19 is a hoax, or the deaths are due to other causes, or it's these fake concepts of herd immunity or discrediting masks. The list went on and on. And unfortunately, a good part of the country bought into that, especially in the middle part of the country, and here in Texas, where I am and where you are, and also in the southern states. And that's how we got to these 330,000 Americans who've lost their lives, and we're still climbing. We'll be up to 400,000 by a week or so after the inauguration. Just a tragedy of monumental proportions.
Indeed. Yes or no? Are any of those things I just said true, being a hoax, being that the flu numbers are being merged, et cetera, et cetera? Are any of those things true?
No, none of them. This was designed to deflect, to downplay the severity of the epidemic. And it's actually a technique that's not unique to the Trump White House. This was done by, if you look at, he went by the same playbook as Bolsonaro in Brazil, who's the head of Brazil, and Duterte in the Philippines, and Daniel Ortega in Nicaragua. This is sadly, it's not unusual, and that's why those countries are disasters as well in terms of COVID-19.
Well, but U.S. has medical expertise where we shouldn't be in this place. So Illinois has a positivity rate at this moment, I believe, of 8.5%. Indiana, lots of listeners in Indiana, 11.8%. Texas, where you are, I looked it up, 10.3%. Idaho is just over 20%. What number is acceptable, aside from zero, what number is acceptable?
Well, you know, some people like to use this 5% as the benchmark. I think that's way too high. I think, you know, we needs to be way down below 1% or 0.1%. You need to get it back down to containment mode. And I put forward a plan over the summer, which I called my October 1 plan, and provided that to the White House. It just got ignored, unfortunately. And the idea behind it was, if we can get the nation down to containment mode or something resembling it, we can then only slow, we'll inevitably see a rise, but the rise will be slow enough so that we'll have vaccines here, and we could have saved probably at least half of those 330,000 lives, maybe two-thirds, but that's not the direction they wanted to go in.
Hmm. Are you working with the Biden White House?
Not so much. You know, the odd contact every now and then, but not, I can't say that, definitely not in the inner circle. And, you know, I've offered to help, just like I offered the Trump White House to help. I've said, anytime you need me to come to Washington or want to pick me to pick up the phone or Skype or Zoom, I'm always there. But there has not been a huge amount of interaction so far.
All right, the big question, and I'm getting lots of text about this question, 312-981-7200. Lots of variants or mutations. This could have been predicted because it is a virus. It's a coronavirus, which we know these viruses change over time. It's what coronaviruses do. Does closing off the borders, which we just kind of did with the UK, you have to be tested to come here. Other countries have closed the borders. Is that going to help? And more importantly, talk about this strain that's been getting all the buzz. It's not the one in South Africa. It's not the one, I think there was one in Brazil, but it's this one. Should we be concerned?
Well, I think we should be concerned. You know, what happened was in the UK, they have this very detailed program of what's called virus genomic surveillance, where they're not only detecting different virus isolates, but they complete the full RNA sequence of the virus. So they have the whole genome. And they've done this with over 150,000 samples. I think by now they're probably close to 200,000. So for a country of 80 million people, that's quite a bit to get the full genome. And they had a really robust system in place, and they were able to see that in Southeast England, a lot of the lineages were being replaced by this one particular one. And on that basis, they project that it's more transmissible, although they've not confirmed that experimentally. But it has a lot of mutations in it. And the question is it already outside? One of the questions is it already outside the UK? Well, the answer is yes. This thing has been around in the UK since September, so it's been percolating for a few months, and it's already in the European Union. It's probably in the United States, just that we're not looking for it. So whereas the UK has done almost 200,000 virus genome sequences, by comparison, for a country our size, we should be at about 1 million virus genome sequences, and we're only about 50,000. So, you know,
why is that?
Was a program led by the CDC. I don't know. I mean, you know, this has been another issue. Now, you can't blame it all on the Trump White House. Our Health and Human Services agencies, mostly the CDC, just have come up small so many times, you know, missing the entry of the virus into the United States from Europe, into New York, the debacle with the diagnostic testing, the lack of epidemiologic models, not now this. And so that's one of the big unknowns, is it, you know, if people just assume it must be due to all the White House encroachments and incursions, and I'm sure that didn't help, but I get the sense there's something else going on. I mean, yet again, you know, why we're just learning about this as of last week, that we're not really doing much in the way of virus genome sequencing. And we're we are the country that more or less was the first to complete the human genome sequence. We should be at the cutting edge. We should have 1 million virus genome sequences. Why are we still so far behind other countries?
Well, and we are with testing too, and we'll talk about that when we come back. And the good news, the vaccine. Lots of your questions. I will get to those, I promise, when we come back with Dr. Peter J. Hotez on WGN. 148 on WGN, Steve Dale on a Sunday afternoon with Dr. Peter J. Hotez. Dr. Hotez, we don't have time for me to list all of these accolades again. How do I best say who you are here in just a phrase?
Vaccine scientist and pediatrician, or pediatrician scientist, I guess, would be fine.
Well, that is perfect, because I have a question I'll get to about children and the vaccine. But first of all, something that's not talked about a lot that I happen to know about. So this is called commonly SARS coronavirus 2, because there was a SARS coronavirus 1. And at that point in time, the government, I believe, the National Institutes of Health and others threw a lot of money, appropriately, at that issue. And vaccine was being studied. And then right after that, the Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome occurred as well. So I believe, you know, everyone talks about the vaccine and how, oh, this is happening so fast. And indeed it has. But actually, and you'll have to explain this, I'm sure you know a lot more about it than I do, but this actually goes back about 17 or 18 years to the SARS coronavirus 1, and vaccine development actually began back then. So while it's happened really fast, not as fast as a lot of people think. Am I right about this?
Yeah, that's right. So when people say, you know, the development program, how could it be? It's just been a few weeks or months. How can it be safe? I point out, no, this is a program that really began after that first SARS emerged out of South China. And if you remember, it wiped out the economy of Toronto for a while. It took a Rolling Stones concert to bring back the Toronto economy. And that's when our National Institutes of Health said, you know, this is not looking good. Maybe there's other coronaviruses out there, and began supporting programs of vaccine development. And we were the beneficiaries of that. We were funded starting about a decade ago to develop prototype coronavirus vaccines. And that's when we learned that the spike protein is the weak link of the virus. It's the soft target. And all of the vaccines work by that. We began making prototype vaccines, developing animal models, showing that if you deliver the spike protein in certain ways, you can protect laboratory animals and safely. All of that went into the COVID-19 vaccine program. In fact, you know, when the sequence of the COVID-19 virus went up on a preprint server in middle January, you know, most of us in the scientific community looked at it and said, yeah, we got this. And we just knew we just had to find different ways to deliver the spike protein. And the idea behind Operation Warp Speed was because of the time pressures to do many things in parallel. So they applied multiple different technologies at once, whether it's the mRNA vaccine or the adenovirus vaccine, or our recombinant protein vaccine. And then the clinical trials are large, robust clinical trials, as big as any of the others. So the only difference between what's happening now and in the past is that in the past, in order to go through full licensure by the Food and Drug Administration, you have to collect a year's worth of data to show that the vaccines are both safe and effective. And the problem there is, if we let this go a whole another year, you know, when you're accelerating to about 3,000 Americans losing their lives every day, you know, you do the math, it'd be a staggering loss of life beyond what's already been staggering. Could be a million lives lost. So the thinking was, we're going to release the vaccines now through emergency use authorization after 2 or 3 months of safety and efficacy data rather than a full year. But the FDA has done a really good job in terms of closely approximating the full licensure process. And that's why I said publicly, look, I'll take any vaccine that's authorized by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. I feel that confident in the process. And sure enough, the Pfizer vaccine came along. I was given the opportunity to take it, and I took it. I got the first dose, and I'll get the second dose in a couple of weeks after the first one.
Well, I've got you beat, perhaps, because I'm in the Moderna trial. I don't know if I had the placebo or the vaccine. I'm going to be finding out, I'm told, fairly soon. And I've read the data, and with the Moderna data that I've gotten, and also the Pfizer data as well, for many of the side effects or adverse reactions, interestingly enough, and I think it's important that we make a point of this, that people who received the placebo had statistically about the same number of adverse events as the people that actually received the vaccine. Now, there are some exceptions, but for a lot of those adverse responses, it was more or less the same whether they got salt water or whether they got the real deal.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a higher rate of sort of fever and fatigue and for one day. I mean, when I got the Pfizer vaccine that evening, I got around 5-6 o'clock in the afternoon. By that evening, maybe I had a slight fever, some arm soreness, some body aches and pains. And when I woke up that morning, I sort of felt some of the body aches and pains. But by mid-morning the next day, I was totally fine. And they say it could be a little bit worse with the second dose. I guess I'll find that out too. But it's a small price to pay given the fact that this is a virus with such deadly consequences.
Now, in Illinois, we're going to begin vaccinating senior citizen centers, actually not senior citizen centers, but assisted living centers as well as nursing homes. And how concerned are you? How important is it that the employees and or any volunteers at facilities such as these are vaccinated in enormous numbers? As the government has, the CDC has said, that's really, really important. Yes, vaccinating the residents, but even more so, the people that work there and volunteer there.
Yeah, absolutely. At the end of the day, they're healthcare providers, and healthcare providers are a top group that's been recommended for vaccination because we have to stabilize the health system. We can't afford to lose too many more people out of the workforce. We don't have enough nurses and docs and respiratory therapists and physician assistants out there to take care of this massive surge that we're seeing now in our hospitals and ICUs. And so it's really important to get the health care. So the idea behind the recommendations from the CDC have been one to, you know, the nursing and home and assisted living residents account for about 39% of the deaths. So they're a top group, but also to stabilize the health system because it's in danger of it's wobbly right now because of this surge that we have. If you've got any ICU you go into now in many parts of the country, staff are being overwhelmed, and that's when the mortality rates really go up as nurses and staff become exhausted.
And what's more, if someone has a heart attack, if someone has a stroke, if someone has a problem where they're needed to be seen, cancer treatment even, all those things, they don't get the same attention necessarily in some parts of the country. So I want to get to some text as quickly as I can here, or additional text. I've asked a few of them. This listener says, I'm allergic to soy, corn, and honey. Should I be concerned, and how can I find out the ingredients of these vaccines?
Yeah, the current recommendation for the Pfizer vaccine has been that even if you have food allergy, to go ahead and get vaccinated. Because that's, and also it's being done in healthcare settings. So if you do have an allergic reaction, you could be managed. The rate may be higher than typical vaccines of severe allergic reaction. So let me give you an example. So for the we've looked into this for the influenza vaccine or the HPV vaccines for cervical cancer and other cancers, it's about 1 to 2 per million severe allergic reactions. For the measles, mumps, rubella, about 3 to 4 per million. Just for a compare, give you a sense of what that number means, that's roughly the number the National Geographic puts out for the number of people struck by lightning in a lifetime. So it's a really rare event. For these, for the Pfizer vaccine, it's really early to say, but it's been noted there have been about 6 or 7 severe allergic reactions in around 300,000 individuals. So roughly 1 in 50,000, but we'll get better numbers hopefully soon, more accurate numbers soon. But let's assume that 1 in 50,000 holds up. It's about 10 times higher severe allergic reactions than the flu or HPV vaccine, but it's still a very rare event. And given how dire things are with COVID-19, I went into that knowing that the risks were a little bit higher, but certainly nothing even close to preventing me from wanting to get vaccinated.
A couple questions here. I have very smart listeners. A couple of questions. We always hear about vaccines That's great, but what about therapeutics? What about drugs that can help us? I know about remdesivir, for example, which actually we can thank cats for, which is a whole different story. I wish I had time to tell you. In addition to that, there are a couple of other therapeutics out there, but there's no magic pill, not quite yet. Are people working on that?
Yeah, you know, unfortunately, the status of antiviral drugs is we're not very advanced in many respects, and we don't have as many antiviral drugs as antibacterial drugs, in part because viruses are a tougher target because they use our own metabolic machinery to reproduce in the body. So there are fewer identifiable targets in viruses compared to bacterials. That's why we have a lot of antibiotics, but not that many antivirals. That's problem number one. It looks like the one that we know seems to be working, if you give it very early on in the course of infection, is the monoclonal antibody, which also targets the spike protein of the virus. So all the vaccines work by inducing an immune response to the spike protein. It takes usually two doses, so around 6 weeks to achieve virus neutralizing antibodies. What the monoclonals do is they provide that virus neutralizing antibody up front. It doesn't last in the body very long, but long enough to prevent you from getting really sick from COVID. The problem is you need to do that very early on in the course of the infection because there's a second part related to the host inflammatory response, and by then the monoclonal antibodies don't do much good. So you have to get it super early on in the infection, and not a lot of people know about it or even know to ask for it, but if you have risk factors and you start getting sick from COVID-19, as soon as possible, you want to contact your physician to see if you can get that monoclonal antibody. It has the added complexity that it has to be administered in a special facility intravenously. So that also limits its use. So we do have our first therapeutics, the monoclonal antibodies, but they're kind of limited in use and scope based on their particular performance characteristics. Hopefully others that are a little more user-friendly will come along later. In the meantime, the best way you can avoid going into an ICU or hospital other than the face mask and social distancing is to get your vaccine.
Yep. You are amazing, sir. A great wealth of information. Unfortunately, we are literally out of time. Dr. Peter J. Hotez, thank you so very much for joining us on WGN.
No, thanks for having me, and look forward to coming back at some future date. And hopefully we'll have better news and we'll have more of the American people vaccinated next time around.